And welcome to the Jim Engster Show. I'm Julie Baxter Payer, and I'm filling in for Jim Engster today. We have a wonderful panel of guests. We want to invite you to call in and be a part of that panel, 1-877-217-5757, on this March 8th edition of the Jim Engster Show. We're going to be joined shortly by Commissioner of Administration Jay Darden. We've just been through a 15-day special session. A lot of talk about what is next for the state of Louisiana, the families of Louisiana. Later in the hour, we will hear from Mark Ballard, who is a political reporter, longtime reporter in the trenches there in the political cauldron at the state capitol. We want to hear from him about what he sees coming up next. And then at the end of the hour, Elaine Weiss. Her book has just been released this week called The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. It's a 20th century political thriller. And good morning. Welcome to Talk Louisiana with Jim Engster. And I am filling in for Jim Engster today. I'm Julie Baxter Payer. We have a wonderful lineup of guests that I know you're going to want to stick around for. You could be a part of the show also by calling in at 1-877-217-5757. We will hear from Mark Ballard, a longtime political reporter at the state capitol, about what's next as we head into the fifth session, the fifth legislative session since Governor John Bel Edwards took office. And also later in the hour, Elaine Weiss with her brand new book just out this week, The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. But first, a man who almost needs no introduction on this particular show, the Commissioner of Administration of the State of Louisiana, Jay Darden, joins us live by phone this morning. Good morning, Jay. Jay? Are you there?
I'm here. Good morning.
Good to hear your voice. And we want to stop for a moment in the middle of heading into this fifth legislative session since Governor John Bel Edwards took office to congratulate you. Actually, this Saturday, you will be inducted into the 26th Annual Hall of Fame in the Louisiana Political Hall of Fame. And we just wanted to say congratulations. Are you looking forward to that momentous occasion in New Orleans?
Well, thank you. I am. It's going to be a fun evening. A lot of my friends are actually being inducted at the same time, and it's always a very, very special event. So it means I'm old and I've been around for a while.
Well, you certainly have. You served as the 53rd Lieutenant Governor of Louisiana from 2010 to 2016, Secretary of State from 2006 to 2010. You were formerly a state senator, I believe elected in 1991. And, you know, when you were a senator, you were a floor leader in the Senate for Republican Governor Mike Foster. And so that gives you a unique vantage point as the governor now, Governor John Bel Edwards, is wrestling with legislators, both in the Senate and particularly in the House, trying to come up with a budget solution. And I wanted to give you a chance to kind of just forecast for us what is next when the state is facing a $994 million budget shortfall to fund the services that most people expect the state to do at this point, perhaps some relief from the federal tax changes, but with constant refusal to move at all in either cuts or revenue increases. What is next? What do you think is different as we head into a legislative session where we can't raise the tax measures?
There's an awful lot of uncertainty. Obviously, the legislature's had several opportunities over the course of the past year to fix this problem that it created when it created temporary taxes to almost 27 months ago, knowing they'd expire in June of this year. So there have been opportunities to fix it, and the legislature hasn't taken any steps to do so. So it's very frustrating. And next week, when the regular session begins and the Appropriations Committee begins its hearings on the budget, I'll be there first thing in the morning on Tuesday to start explaining the very real consequences of their inaction, because we've been talking for a year about what would happen if we didn't fix this now, and we're now going to face that reality as we have to start talking about the potential for layoffs, not only in state government but in the private sector, because so much of the money that the state does not have goes into the private market to provide particular services, particularly in the healthcare arena. And so we'll be talking about the consequences of this inaction and the difficulty that parents and students are going to face as they decide where to go to college next fall, wondering whether or not TOPS will be funded or not. So it creates a very unfortunate level of upheaval and uncertainty right now that I hope we'll be able to fix in yet another special session, because we'll adjourn the regular session early in May, and go right into another special session because the legislature can't raise any revenue in an even-numbered year, so they have to be in a special session. So they'll be called upon to basically replace. This is not new money. This is replacement of the temporary money that was passed a year or so ago.
What is different, though, about going into the regular legislative session where we try to balance the budget every year? It's a duty of the legislature to balance the state budget. Having not accomplished what you wanted to accomplish in the special session, what would have been different if you had been able to do what the governor wanted to do in the special session?
There won't be a budget in the regular session. The legislature will not be able to pass a budget in the regular session. There's no way, I believe, that they'll do so because the cuts are going to be too draconian and too dramatic. And even those who like to say we can just cut our way out of this problem, I don't think they'll put their name on the level of cuts that are going to be necessary to balance the budget if we don't have the $994 million. Or the more realistic number, which is going to be around 692 or 600 some odd, based upon the money that the state will recognize from the changes at the federal level. Now, those dollars can't be recognized until the Revenue Estimating Conference certifies that they're a part of the estimate. And that's not going to happen until after, I don't believe that's going to happen until after the regular session ends early and we launch into the next special session. So I don't look for a budget to be enacted until that special session convenes in mid-May.
So earlier this week, one of our U.S. senators said, I think this is pretty close to a quote, people are getting tired of these so-called fiscal crises and fiscal cliffs. Frankly, they don't believe them anymore. Is it just sort of a way to politically message to talk about a cliff, or are we looking at something that families in Louisiana will actually see a difference in their life if we don't balance this budget?
Of course it's real. I mean, you know, John Kennedy knows good and well that it's real, and he loves to make these general political statements but not come up with any solutions or any answers or any explanation as to what he thinks ought to be done. And he knows good and well from his time as treasurer, the guy who is in charge of investing the state's money and evaluating how much money we have. He knows the reality that this fiscal cliff is very real. And anybody, even a casual observer of politics, would know that if the legislature enacts a temporary tax it totals almost $1 billion, and it goes away, that there is going to clearly be a hole in the budget of the state, and that's where we are right now. And those who have said we don't have a problem, it's a spending problem, and we can cut our way out of this, well, they're going to now be called upon to say, okay, tell us where you're going to cut. This is what I've certainly been saying for the past year and a half to those people who are making these arguments. Tell us what you think the state ought to be cutting. Tell us what you think we ought not be doing. Because the reality is this $1 billion shortfall has to be balanced against, and I put quotes around this, only about $3.5 billion in revenue that represents the state general fund that can actually be cut by the legislature. The rest of it is constitutionally dedicated.
Phil from Jefferson Terrace is online, too, if you'll take a call, Jay. Phil, welcome to Talk Louisiana with Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Oh, thank you. Is this Jay Darden?
Yes.
Yes, it is.
Okay, Darden. Mr. Darden, first of all, I want to thank you. I think you are an example of an honest public servant. I know you took a lot of political risk, and I thank you. You know, the thing is, Sinclair Lewis said that it's difficult to persuade a man to understand the truth when his salary depends on him not understanding it. I challenge the legislators, would they take a lie detector test about the fact that they profess about what our budget is? I mean, would you take a lie detector test? I doubt that they would. But anyway, thank you. Thank you again, Mr. Darden.
Thank you. I don't know that anybody's required to take a lie detector test, but we have to keep talking about the reality that we're facing and call upon people who like to talk in generalities to get specific. And that's what's going to happen now, because we are facing the reality of not having this money if the legislature doesn't do something. And they're going to get an opportunity to stand up and say, well, we don't think we ought to have this revenue, so here are the cuts we think we can make. And when it gets down to it, I don't think anybody's going to be able to point to the level of cuts that are necessary to make this happen. The services are too important, and obviously higher education. It's the first time higher education has ever not taken a cut in the budget that we're under this year, in the past 10 years. And we hate to see that end, and we hate to reverse that, hopefully, change in trend, because higher education is a priority for this administration, and we want to make certain we reverse the practices of the past where the previous administration just said, let's just work raise tuition, and the state's going to keep reducing its contribution to higher education. And the result is our universities are suffering and our students are suffering because we can't fund TOPS.
In her column this week, Louisiana Spotlight, Melinda DeLotte reported that Representative Barry Ivey said to her that he's been told, we don't want a Democrat to get reelected and we don't want to give him a political win by doing tax reform. That was something that was told to me, talking about some of his Republican friends. Do you think that is at the heart of this resistance to do anything to balance this budget on the part of Republicans?
I thought Barry's speech on the floor of the House was probably the most honest comments that have been made over the course of the past year in legislative debate. And unfortunately, I do think that is at the heart of some of the problems. I do think there is a mindset among some Republicans that they have to do everything they can do to make sure John Bell doesn't have a chance at reelection. And that's unfortunate. And I've been around the legislature in times where I was a Republican in the minority, but there was always a sense of working together to try and do what was best for the state. And we seem to have lost that objective, that we have to put our party politics aside and seize the opportunity to do what's right for Louisiana. And that has not taken place over the course of this administration. And I wish they would, because you have people who are intelligent enough to realize that we're on the cusp of some very good things happening in the state, and we can't blow it and be our own worst enemy by letting our budget collapse and letting our bond rating go further and further into the tank.
We'll be right back with Dan from downtown on Talk Louisiana. And welcome back to Talk Louisiana with Jim Engster. And we're privileged to have Commissioner of Administration Jay Darden joining us for this additional segment here on the show. Dan from downtown had a question for you, Jay. Dan?
Yes. Is another problem that many of these Republican legislators have taken the Grover Norquist no taxes no matter what pledge?
I don't know how many have. I know that a number of them probably have, and certainly that was one of the issues in the previous administration when the legislature wrestled with what to do about the budget, and everything pretty much had to be passed by Grover Norquist to make sure that it was not considered a tax, so that the Governor Jindal could say that he was not supporting a tax. And that's what kind of led us into the $2 billion problem that Governor Edwards faced when he took office, because we had just used this one-time money over and over and over and gone through some gyrations like this, the so-called SAVE Act, that really just was a facade, a way of saying we weren't raising taxes when we were just moving money around. So that certainly has been a contributor to part of the problem we're facing right now.
Thank you, Dan, for your question. Jay, what is it that you think you've been involved in a lot of campaigns out there around the state with a lot of voters? What is it that you think Republican legislators are hearing from their voters that are encouraging them that this is a win for Republican legislators? Obviously, they've been effective so far in their efforts to just stop everything sort of in its tracks and not move forward either with cuts or revenue increases as in looking at the responsibility of balancing a budget. Do you think that there's something that they're hearing in particular from voters that are encouraging them to take that step?
Well, look, it's no secret that people don't want their taxes raised. I mean, there's no question about that. That's a generally held view, particularly in a conservative red state like Louisiana. People don't want to have to pay more in taxes. But one of the hallmarks, I would say, of this administration, particularly compared to what we've seen previously, is that we're trying to tell people the truth and say, look, this is the reality of what our budget used to look like, and this is the reality of what it looks like today. These are the services that we're trying to provide. You have to decide whether or not you want to just stop these services and not have any revenue to replace what is rolling off. Because, once again, these dollars that we're talking about are dollars that have been a part of the Louisiana budget. This is not new tax money. This is money that is replacing the existing tax base of the state, doing it purportedly in a different way. We had this recommendation from the task force that the legislature created that said, let's rethink how we impose taxes in Louisiana. Let's try and broaden the base, make it more fair, get away from this situation where we lurch from year to year not knowing what our budget's going to look like. It was trying to stabilize things, and the recommendations put forth by the task force are precisely what the governor has recommended we do, and the legislature thus far has been unwilling to do that. And I think we have to be honest with the people of this state, and we see all the lists that we're at the bottom of and all the frustrations we have about the way things are going in Louisiana, and realistically, they're going good. We've got a lot of potential right now that we've got to take advantage of, and we can't be our own worst enemy as we've been so many times in the past. And although I know people generally say, I don't want my taxes raised, I think if you're honest with them and you show them what it is we're going to do with this money and what services we're not going to be able to provide if we don't maintain the level of revenue that we have right now, I think most people in this state are going to be open to what needs to be done. And I hope it's not going to be clouded. It's always going to have a political overlay to it, but I hope everything's not going to be clouded by a motivation to make sure that a Democrat governor is unsuccessful in the state of Louisiana.
One of the conversations I've heard this week is about TOPS and the governor's budget proposing quite significant cuts to TOPS, and the governor repeatedly saying they're not cuts that he wants to make, but this is what would be required if we don't balance the budget and do some of the things that you all were looking to do in the special session. What is the trade-off that people would make in terms of what are they facing in terms of TOPS cuts versus what would the administration be asking them to give in terms of either higher taxes or some other way of balancing the budget?
Well, TOPS is now about a $300 million program, and about $60 million of that is dedicated from a statutory source, and so that is proposed to continue and would be funded. So it's about $240 million that is in the state general fund to fund TOPS. And given the $1 billion that are coming off the books, and the fact that we have only about $3.5 billion available in the general fund to fund higher education and health care predominantly, that's where the problem is. And literally almost 80% of that budget goes to higher education, TOPS, and health care. And as much as we want to make certain we fund TOPS, we just simply cannot do so at the expense of health care, because health care cuts are total about $636 million of this $1 billion, and that doesn't count the over $2 billion in federal money that is matched by those state general fund dollars. So it's a balancing act of how you allocate this massive reduction that we're facing if there's not some substitute revenue that comes into play. At the end of the day, we absolutely want to see TOPS fully funded. That's why the governor called the special session when he did in February and early March to say, let's fix it now so parents and students know what the status of TOPS is as they make decisions this spring about where they're going to go to college next fall. Unfortunately, the legislature once again failed to act, and so we're going to continue to have this uncertainty as to what the fate of TOPS is going to be until we know what's going to happen to fix the fiscal cliff.
Frank from Zachary is on line two. Good morning, Frank. Welcome to Talk Louisiana. What's your question for Jay?
Good morning, Julie. Good morning, Commissioner. I have a question. As a person who considers himself to be a fiscal conservative, which a lot of our legislators want to label themselves as, how does a fiscal conservative, quote unquote, kind of justify belief in a top system that basically is you know, socialized? I mean, it's subsidized, you know, education for all. It's the opposite of fiscal conservatism. I know it's become the third rail of our budget, you know, talks. No one can touch it. No one can you know, threaten it. But the fact is that if you're a conservative, how could you justify a government paying for education? I mean, I don't know. It seems a bit hypocritical if you address that. Or
Jay, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't completely agree with your assessment of it for this reason. I think TOPS was originally designed, and it was a $90 million or so program when it began. It's ballooned to $300 million now in the state budget, but originally the concept was to reward academic achievement by high school students and encourage them to matriculate in Louisiana. And it certainly has served that purpose, although we do have a lot of Louisiana students who get educated here and go to work elsewhere because we haven't created the level of jobs that we need in the state. TOPS is not only probably the most popular thing the legislature's done. I think it's been a great incentive for students to do well in high school, knowing that they'll have an opportunity to get that assistance to study in Louisiana. And it is also viewed by many, I think this is probably an accurate portrayal, it is become almost an entitlement to the middle class, because a lot of the middle class and even those in the higher income bracket do benefit from TOPS and don't wind up having to pay anything. And that's one of the points that you're making. But I think it has also created a great incentive for students to do well academically, which is what the original motivation was. So I don't know that it's contrary to fiscal conservatism as much as it's just a representation that the state is making an investment in education, an investment in our young people, trying to keep them here in Louisiana.
Jay, what is your suggestion to people listening out there who might have an opinion one way or other, cuts, revenue raising, save TOPS, don't save TOPS? What would you like to see people impress upon their legislators in terms of any messages that you might want the legislature to hear directly from voters?
You know, I'm a product of the legislature, having been in the Senate for 15 years, and always felt like the input from constituents was critical. And when I was there, emails and communication like that were an evolving message. But nowadays it's even easier to get in touch with legislators via email, via Twitter, whatever the case may be. Social media has made it real easy to communicate with legislators. But people just need to be more engaged. I think the public, generally speaking, has been kind of
run out of time. But I want to thank you.
They've been kind of lethargic about the matter.
And welcome back to Talk Louisiana with Jim Engster. I'm Julie Baxter Payer, filling in for Jim today. And we're privileged, having just bid farewell to Commissioner of Administration Jay Darden in the previous segment, to welcome now another Capitol aficionado, Mark Ballard, who's been a reporter there in the trenches at the state capitol for a long time now. Mark, good morning, and thank you for joining us on Talk Louisiana.
Morning, Julie. How you doing?
I'm doing well, and I know you're a regular here with the listeners at Talk Louisiana. You wrote in your column on Monday that coming at the end of the special session, which the 15 days has just ended, and we're going into a new session Monday, the regular legislative session, you wrote that there were Republicans double-fisted handshakes and slapped backs as members of the House Republican Gang of No sort of congratulated each other. What was the big win for that group, do you think, out of the special session?
Well, and you need to keep in mind this is just a faction of the Republican Party in there, and their big win was to get out of this session without getting any taxes passed. And then there's also a group of them in there that wanted to get out of this session by making the governor look bad.
And do you find that they were successful on both counts?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the session was obviously the session kind of fell apart. There was no real revenue increases passed, and so now we go into the regular session that starts on Monday with still $1 billion short. At least that's what the budget is going to be saying. And I think that the governor kind of lost on this because, I mean, he called the special session, and it was sort of incumbent upon him at some point, you know, to get something done. And nothing was done, though, I mean, there's a lot of blame to go around. So,
and talking about that blame, in your reporting, did you uncover that there indeed was a deal that was proposed by the House Speaker, and then sort of he backed away from that in the early days of the special session?
Well, now, if you talk to the governor, he called it a deal. There was a deal that you know, that there would be a specific amount of money that would be raised off of the sales tax. There would be a corresponding a bill that would raise money through changes in the income tax. And he says it was a deal. The speaker said that it was not so much a deal, but more of a kind of a framework of which that he could do it. And in the end, the speaker could not get, I mean, he came up about 6 or 7 votes shy of getting the 40 votes that he needed. that with the Democrats would have been enough to pass the legislation that would have raised the revenues, increased taxes, as is what it is, and that kind of fell apart on the first day when the if you're in John Bel Edwards' camp or framework, if you're in Taylor Barra's camp, fell apart when they were looking for to extend a half cent of the penny that is about to expire, and he just couldn't get the votes for that. So he being Barra and couldn't get the votes for that. So they kind of changed that up and made it a quarter penny, and you know then you had the agreement. It was kind of a gentleman's agreement that you know we would pass this. If and we will also pass some of the fiscal reform measures, so-called, that the Republicans wanted to see. But then they tacked that onto the bill saying, you know, if you don't pass it, then everything, all this blows up. And that kind of annoyed a lot of the Democrats.
It seemed like there was a lot of annoyance in the special session. Do you see a mathematical pathway that works politically that maybe legislators are missing in terms of trying to balance this budget?
Well, I mean, I kind of agree with the House Clerk Butch Spears that, I mean, basically we have very sharp philosophical differences about what the role of government is, and they've got to work through those, and that's kind of what this session was about, and we're a long way from being able to work through that. Now, there is some changes. The price of oil has gone up, so that there will be increased revenues from that. There is some, they say, up to $300 million that the state will see from the changes that were done on the federal level. And so that kind of knocks down the impact of losing that penny by about half. So we're looking at about a $500 million deficit now.
Well, and do you think that – what are you hearing? I know you talk to a lot of legislators and administration folks a lot, but you also talk to citizens. Are you hearing that people are ready to swap – sort of cuts in state services rather than having to raise revenue? Are you hearing that from everyday citizens?
Well, it depends on where they are philosophical, where they fall on that philosophical divide, if you will. I mean, so you have a group of citizens that want to protect the Medicaid, to protect health care for the elderly, for the low income, and for children. They want to protect that at all costs. And then you the other services that we're talking about. Then you have the other group that want to protect, higher education and TOPS, and think that what we really need to do is cut Medicaid. And so, I mean, this philosophical divide is going to play itself out, you know, over the coming weeks, starting on Monday.
Have you begun to hear any conversations in your walking the halls there at the Capitol now, as we finished with the special session, going into the regular legislative session, that there's been any change of opinion by some of the key leaders there or some of the legislators, given what happened in the special session? Is there a difference in any of the conversations you're hearing now?
Well, I think that there's emerging a kind of strong centrist, if you will. I mean, you know, you have the Gang of No, and then you have, you know, like the Black Caucus and some of the more liberal Democrats. And then in the middle, you're finding more and more Republicans and Democrats that are saying it's time just to do something, you know, and if that'll include raising some revenues, and that'll also include having some sort of cuts. They were very frustrated by what happened during the session, over the last few sessions, primarily because, you know, they keep asking for big, bold plans, you know, and nobody actually has any new bold plans. And when they presented some, these folks from the middle, they were all just shot down. So I'm seeing or hearing at least that there's a lot more, anger or fire at least coming from this center portion of the legislature.
Well, when you talk about big, bold plans, your paper has partnered with the Manship School for this SolveTheBudget.com website, taking ideas from some bright young students at the Manship School, the Riley Center, and I guess your paper as well have put this together where people can go on and pick what they like in terms of solving the budget. Have you heard of any legislators maybe looking there to see what people are coming up with?
Well, yeah, I mean, I've seen legislators actually playing the game, you know, on their laptops. But what we hear is that, I mean, and part of this comes from having districts that are so drawn so specifically that, you know, where you may feel you could kind of go out a little bit on a particular philosophy or point of view, they're in districts where that's not really the case. I mean, that they don't feel like that their constituents are hard against taxes,
right,
or, you know, again, and so that's what I'm hearing, is that, you know, they feel like they can't do it, that they're more fearful of, we have more Republicans in obviously, they're more fearful of them voting on a sales tax, for instance, and then having a candidate coming from them from the right. They're feeling
right.
like
So it's easier to play the game on your phone than to actually take the votes on the floor.
Right. And
let me ask you, we just have a few minutes left. What do you see in this regular session as some of the highlights that people will be hearing about, some of the more contentious, interesting sort of battles of wits and votes that we'll see in this regular session?
Well, I think more than anything else, we're going to see, you know, a toe-to-toe fisticuffs over the budget and whether or not state government can be cut more, or particular programs will be cut more, whether TOPS will be fully funded, whether higher education will be fully funded. That will be. We're also looking at, there's proposals, the gambling proposals, that basically the casinos want to move their riverboat casinos onshore, and there's legislation that would do that. There's a number of different kind of proposals that we can't use expand, because that's a terrible term, at least in Louisiana politics, but that will I can't think of a better word.
Enlarge?
Enlarge, yeah. Casino gambling, which is now, I think, the third largest source of funding right now, higher than oil and gas right now, that will enlarge that industry, make it that industry more competitive. We'll be seeing that. We'll also be seeing, a sexual harassment policy that will basically make across the board. Each agency has its own little policy, but it'll make it across the board throughout state government. I think we'll be seeing that. I think there's going to be fisticuffs over changing what TOPS is going to look like, you know, whether there will be increasing the standards or limiting who gets it. I mean, I think that fight we're going to see as well during this session.
Jay Darden just told us that he didn't believe that legislators would pass the budget that it would take to be a balanced budget before a possible additional special session that would be sort of at the end of the regular special session. Would you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, I think, you know, realistically that's what's going to happen. We have seen over the last decade, you know, where they talk about cutting spending and they do, you know, cut some spending, but they don't actually eliminate any of these programs, and that costs a lot of money, because, you know, it's nice on a theoretical level to say, you know, let's get rid of, you know, this particular program, but in the real world it's very difficult, and they've been unable to do so. And so I think that's what's going to happen here, is that they'll
Thank
talk
you,
about
Mark.
Cutting it.
We appreciate your time here on Talk Louisiana. We're going to be joined by Elaine Weiss, the author of The Woman's Hour, when we come back. Welcome back to Talk Louisiana with Jim Engster. I'm Julie Baxter Payer, filling in for Jim today, and we have a great honor now to be joined by Elaine Weiss, the author of a book called The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. And this book has just been released this week, and Elaine Weiss, we're so pleased to be able to talk to you for just a few moments here on Talk Louisiana with Jim Engster. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
And The Woman's Hour is being described as a 20th century political thriller that has all the trappings of a contemporary news report. The scene is Nashville in August 1920, nearly 100 years ago. The presidential election weeks away. One last state is needed to ratify the 19th Amendment, granting women the vote. Over 70 years of struggle all comes down to Tennessee. How did you decide? This is a beautiful book, by the way, and how did you decide to delve into this emotional and political battle for your book?
Well, I realized that as an American woman citizen who always votes in every election and taught my children to do the same, I really didn't know how it came about that I had the vote. I never realized that it was at all controversial. And when I came across this story in some archival research showing that all the themes of the suffrage movement come to a head in this 1 6-week incredibly colorful, dramatic battle in Nashville, Tennessee over ratification of the 19th Amendment, I realized that I could tell this larger story of how women fought to get their equal rights over 7 decades. And it became a very compelling story, both in an historic sense, because it's a pivotal political battle, one of the great political battles in our history. It's also a civil rights movement. It's a women's rights movement. And all of this comes together in this, as you said, a really thrilling story of all the forces coming together, gathering in Nashville. It's sort of the Alamo of the suffrage
and
movement, and it's make or break.
Right. And it's not a clean battle, as you write about. Taking sides are politicians with careers at stake, liquor companies, media barons, railroad magnates, and racists who didn't want to see black women win the vote. In the steamy August of 1920, they stage a vicious face-off replete with dirty tricks, betrayals, and bribes, bourbon, bigotry, and the Bible. At the last moment, a decisive vote of conscience. Now, you submitted your manuscript on the day before the 2016 election, I think it was, with the expectation that a woman president would probably be sitting in the White House when your book was published. So in the last 18 months, how have the current events changed your view of the book you wrote or the themes that are in your book?
Well, that's a great question. It's true that I wrote this book of history. But I think what readers will find, it's both an incredibly compelling read because it's just a great story. It's very colorful. It's very dramatic. It's very fast-paced. But within it are a lot of issues and a lot of questions that we're still grappling with today. And in the 18 months since I finished the manuscript, I realize that it's taken on levels of meaning that I couldn't have anticipated, because this is a book about ordinary women, housewives, teachers, Sunday school teachers, coming together and saying something is wrong. We are not being treated equally. We do not have our rights, and we are going to agitate to get them. And they march in the streets, and then, of course, I see women marching in the streets in the last few years. We're going to lobby. We're going to make our voices heard, even though in 1920 they don't have representation. Now we do. I see those themes of organizing, of coming together to right a wrong, being replayed now. And so it's very energizing, I think, and it'll mean a lot to modern readers to read how this all unfolded a century and more ago and see that some of those same issues of rights, of equality, of dark money in politics, because that enters into this story, of racism, that's a big part of this story, of women's role in society, we're still debating that. These are all the themes in this book, packaged in this kind of thriller-like story of the last battle that, that happens in Tennessee.
And even though this great victory was won so many years ago, I know some folks still look around at the number of women that are elected in various legislators and political bodies around the United States and wonder why maybe more women haven't been able to be elected or haven't run for office. Have you touched on some of those themes as you talk about your book around the country?
Yes, of course. When women finally do win the vote, there's a question of whether they will vote as a woman's vote. You know, will it be monolithic?
Right.
And of course it's not. And we see that still very much is the case now. But there are women's issues that you would think that there would be a coalescing electoral power around. And I'm not sure. We sometimes see that. We sometimes don't. As far as women running for office, which is part of the same question but slightly different slant, it's absolutely true that only about 20% of our representatives in Congress, in the Congress, in the Senate, are women. And you think, well, we make up more than half of the voters at this point. Why are more women not being elected? In the state houses, I think it's about 23 or 24%. Again, only a quarter, not a half. And that's a very important question. I think it's something we should be thinking about. And I know there are organizations like
right.
Emily's List and She Should Run who are definitely trying to change that calculus. But it's something that we need to talk about. That said, women should have the right to vote for whomever they want.
Correct.
but I think that the idea of who represents us is the next phase of this question.
And what's so fun in terms of reading your book is the characters that are in your book, the individuals who made the difference. Do you have a favorite character or story depicted in The Woman's Hour?
Well, there's so many stories. There are great characters. There are great characters who are suffrage leaders. And there are great characters who are anti-suffragists. As a writer, the colorful anti-suffragists, you know, were kind of favorites of mine because it was so counterintuitive. How could we even think? I never thought that there were groups of women who strongly opposed the enfranchisement of their sisters.
Well, what was their reasoning behind that?
It was a variety of reasoning, depending upon where they came out. And one of the rationales was that, and this was especially of conservative, socially conservative women, politically or religiously conservative, that this was not in God's plan. Adam was supposed to be master over Eve. That was God's plan, and any idea that women should have a political voice is totally without merit and should not be. It's going to disturb the moral foundations of our nation. They really say that. It's also, in their mind, going to interfere with the home. Men will not be lord of the castle anymore. They need to be able. There are anti-suffrage advertisements show a pair of pants and says, who's going to wear the pants in your family when women get the vote?
Wow.
And so you see this fear of the whole social structure of the nation being undermined. And I think what this reminds us is a very important lesson, which is women's suffrage, women's rights, was not just a political issue. It was a cultural and social, and for some people, moral issue. And so it is almost the way what we call a culture war, and it invoked great passions on both sides. It was much more complicated than just the vote. It was what was women's role in society going to be? And that was what was being decided, and that's why it becomes such a vicious and colorful, for the reader, battle.
Well, thank you so much, Elaine Weiss, the author of Woman's Hour and The Great Fight to Win the Vote. This is a book. It was just released yesterday or
yes.
Monday. Yeah.
Yes, yesterday.
Congratulations on this book, and we really are grateful for you joining us here on Talk Louisiana with Jim Engster to talk about it. And I suppose the book is available wherever good books are available.
Absolutely, and there's also an ebook and audiobook.
Thank you so much, Elaine Weiss. We appreciate your time. And The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote, a thriller talking about all the characters and individuals involved in this particular fight in 1920. And it's been a real pleasure to be here with you all today, filling in for Jim Engster on Talk Louisiana. We've had a chance to talk with Jay Darden, the Commissioner of Administration, and Mark Ballard, both involved in those very important battles down at the state capitol. And thank you. I'm Julie Baxter Payer. I really appreciate you joining us and all the callers here on Talk Louisiana with Jim Engster.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.